Last month, the Berkeley City Council voted unanimously to require cell phone retailers to warn customers about possible radiation exposure. The Right to Know ordinance is being challenged by the Wireless Association. If the legislation survives the challenge, Berkeley will be the first city in the nation to require the warning. A few years ago, San Francisco dropped a similar ordinance after the Wireless Association successfully sued. According to the World Health Organization, radiation from cell phones can possibly cause cancer. So what does the latest science tell us about cell phone safety, and what questions do you have? Join us after the news. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, the Berkeley City Council unanimously voted to require electronics retailers to warn customers about the potential health risks associated with cell phone radiation. But as in other previous attempts by cities to enact the Right to Know laws about cell phone radiation, the Wireless Association has sued the city of Berkeley over these radiation warning labels, claiming the ordinance violates association members' First Amendment rights. In 2010, San Francisco became the first city in the country to pass a cell phone warning ordinance, but the legislation was blocked in court in response to the Wireless Industries Trade Association. As cities across the country consider similar legislation, 195 scientists from 39 countries have published an open letter warning about serious concerns regarding the ubiquitous and increasing exposure to EMF generated by electric and wireless devices. They're calling on government agencies to impose sufficient guidelines to protect the general public, particularly children who are more vulnerable to the effects of EMF. So should cell phone and wireless technology safety guidelines be strengthened? What do you think of these warning laws? And what does the science tell us about the health impacts of cell phone and other devices? Today, we are joined by Dr. Deborah Davis, an award-winning scientist, author, and founding director of Environmental Health Trust. That's a nonprofit whose mission is to educate citizens and communities about controllable environmental health risks and policy changes needed to reduce those risks. Deborah is author of the book, Disconnect, The Truth About Cell Phone Radiation. Hi, Deborah. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you, Rose. Nice to be with you again.
Great to have you. And joining me in studio is Camilla Reese, a health and environmental activist and co-author of the book Public Health SOS, The Shadow Side of the Wireless Revolution. Camilla is also founder of the Campaign for Radiation-Free Schools. Hi, Camilla. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. And Dr. Erica Mallory Blythe is a medical doctor. She is now one of the United Kingdom's few professional advisors on medical conditions related to radio frequency radiation and other electromagnetic fields. Hi, Dr. Blythe. Thank you for coming in.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So, Deborah, I want to start off with you. A couple of years ago, the World Health Organization put out a paper saying that radiation from cell phones can possibly cause cancer. The WHO lists cell phone use in the same carcinogenic hazard category as engine exhaust, chloroform, and lead. Now, this is a pretty charged issue. When you bring this up, a lot of people say, but the science is out there. It says that cell phones are perfectly safe. What does this latest science tell us about cell phone safety?
Well, so, what the latest science says is that cell phones are not perfectly safe, and it depends on how we use them and how close they are to our bodies. What we know is the following. When the World Health Organization issued that report in 2011, they reviewed all the evidence at that time. Studies published since then indicate that cell phone radiation is a probable human carcinogen, and in addition, that cell phone radiation can damage sperm and have effects on pregnancy. And one thing I'd like to point out, the court did not overturn the city of San Francisco's proposed ordinance of information about cell phones. The court actually upheld the right of the city to inform its citizens about microwave radiation from cell phones, but it overturned the specific type of information that was going to be provided. So, in fact, the courts have sustained the right of cities to protect public health and safety, and ironically, in the Right to Know ordinance that just passed in Berkeley, That ordinance simply says you have a right to know what's currently buried inside your phone with information that the cell phone industry itself includes.
And you've been on the show a few times talking about this. So most people do not read the fine print on their phone. And you've also pointed out that that fine print on many of the iPhones is not, you can't make the font larger. So it's almost impossible to read it even if you wanted to. What do those policies tell us?
Well, if you go to your iPhone, and by the way, all phones have this, and you go to settings, and from settings you go to general, then to about, and then scroll all the way down to legal and to RF exposure, you will see there a warning that says to reduce exposure to radio frequency radiation, also, by the way, known as microwave radiation, use a headset or a hands-free device. That information you can find, by the way, on the website showthefineprint.org. That website puts together all of the warnings that all smartphones have today. And what this tells us is something very simple. All of these phones are, in fact, tested at a distance away from the body with a phantom based on a large male. Now, what we know is that this radiation, if directly in the pockets, will exceed the amount that's tested. And that's what that is telling us.
And so we asked the Wireless Association to join us. They declined our request, but they did send us a statement. This is from Theodore Olson of the law firm Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. He writes, quote, Berkeley's ordinance plainly violates the First Amendment. The ordinance also unlawfully interferes with FCC regulations and contradicts the federal government's determination based on extensive scientific evidence that cell phones approved for sale in the U.S. do not pose a public health risk. It is unconstitutional to force cell phone retailers to communicate false, misleading, and inflammatory information about their products. It's unfortunate that Berkeley would incite unfounded public anxiety and fear about a product that is so important to citizens' everyday lives. Again, this is from Theodore Olson of the law firm Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher, and he's with the CTIA, the Wireless Association. Deborah, what is your response?
Mr. Olson should know better. Actually, you have to ask, why do the governments of France and Belgium and Israel and Finland and Australia all provide information and in some cases have passed laws? For example, in Belgium, it's against the law to advertise or sell a cell phone to be used by a seven-year-old. In Taiwan, you can be fined for giving a cell phone to a two-year-old. Yet we in the United States and the UK are marketing apps for infants. The reality is these warnings are inside the phone because the manufacturers provide them. To argue that it's a violation of their First Amendment rights to have them tell you explicitly what they bury inside the phone is farcical.
Dr. Mallory Blythe, you're from the UK. What are your thoughts on the response from the CTIA over the ordinance that just passed in Berkeley?
People should certainly have a right to understand the health risks and to give informed consent. And we have to take a special look at groups that can't give informed consent. And so by that, I mean young children. There's certainly exposures at the moment to non-consenting, sometimes non-benefiting groups like that. In the UK, we do have a governmental warning against the use of cell phones for people under 16. What I find a little bit frustrating is, whilst that warning is there, even though tablets can have a higher SAR or specific absorption rate, they're not using a warning for those devices, which is... So really, we should be extrapolating that warning to other similar devices.
And so what would you tell us about what the science says, the latest studies that have come out?
Here in the US and also in the UK, we're using the ICNIRP or ICNIRP thermally protective guidelines. So that's only designed to protect human beings against tissue heating or heating of cells. But what we now know is that there are tens of thousands of papers showing biological effects orders of magnitude below that level, which we call non-thermal effects. There's a wealth of literature. It really shouldn't still be in dispute. So we need to start revisiting those safety guidelines and lowering them, as so many other countries have, to be more biologically sensible.
And you work on children specifically, Camilla. You have founded the Campaign for Radiation-Free Schools. What concerns you the most about what we're facing right now? Mm-hmm. I was surprised to learn that there are these iPad or iPod bouncies for babies. And a lot of these wearable devices are now being marketed not only to children, but to newborns and infants.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a range of products that have wireless functionality now, including even putting iPads in the neonatal intensive care unit in some hospitals. It's absolutely insane because there's an energy there. You can't see it, but it's there. And it pushes the biology and it causes dysregulation in the system. So for children, we're particularly concerned because they are going to be more vulnerable to this kind of exposure. And whether we're talking about, you know, use of a cell phone or in schools where they are being blanketed all day long in this Wi-Fi radiation and using tablets and things to interact with those transmitters. And we saw yesterday in San Francisco at the Commonwealth Club, Dr. Carl Merritt present information of what that radiation looks like in a classroom where there are these extraordinary peaks. And those are the times when the children are experiencing the symptoms. And so it is, we know there are acute symptoms, and the big question is the long-term chronic effects on the biology. And as Dr. Davis has said, you know, we're conducting an enormous experiment and, without any controls.
Deborah, on past shows, you've said that a lot of the studies that are conducted in the United States are funded by industry. Has that changed? And what studies are currently happening right now for children?
Well, the answer to your question is that I know of no studies of cell phone radiation's impact on children. My colleague, Dr. Sharma, came and presented with me to the Asilomar meeting of the Bioelectromagnetic Society, where we discussed the literature that's been published from India showing effects on hearing in young people with heavy cell phone use. And these are published studies that have not been widely known. So certainly we should have a commitment to such studies. But, Rose, as we've discussed before, there is a bias here. First of all, there aren't many studies underway. And secondly, most of the studies that have been published, including, by the way, studies for the World Health Organization, have been heavily sponsored by industry. And analyses that have been done independently show that, depending on sponsorship, you can predict the results. We have called in the past for a 2 cents a device fee on every device, on every consumer, on every provider, on every user, and every manufacturer, so that we would generate over a period of 8 years the money needed to fund research and training and monitoring and surveillance for these effects. Cell phones have never been tested for safety, nor, for that matter, have laptops. We need to understand that if cell phones were a drug, they would be illegal, because we have to do monitoring and surveillance. And although our laws say that we should be checking for impacts and checking for radiation from phones, we are not doing that.
And Dr. Mallory Blythe, we often hear that there's really no consensus on this issue, that we need more studies. But there have been cases where families and people who've lost loved ones have connected brain tumors to long-term cell phone use. How do doctors link brain tumors or other health issues to the use of cell phones?
Generally, I think at the moment it's courts of law, I think, that you're talking about, and particularly the case in Italy, in Cente Marcolini, there was a case there where an acoustic neuroma, I believe, was linked to chronic cell phones use. So there's three different perspectives on this, really. There's the scientific perspective, the clinical medical doctor perspective, and then decisions in courts of law. And those are all made via very different pathways. Medical doctors are very much behind on this issue on a sort of frontline level. So when patients come to complain about symptoms that may be related to our health effects, most of those doctors have no information at all. So a lot of the work that you're talking about linking cell phones and brain tumours has been done by epidemiologists like Dr. Davis and other scientists in that forum, with the support of clinicians who've had years of experience looking at brain tumours. But we're really at the beginning, I think, of probably a great deal of litigation to come.
Really? Dr. Davis, what would you add to that?
Well, we published a study on acoustic neuroma showing that it was significantly elevated in long-term cell phone users in 2010. And since then, more literature has been published by Leonard Hardell in Sweden showing that the longest-term cell phone users had the largest acoustic neuromas and the greatest risk. In addition, studies have been published on the brain tumor risk that show that those who begin to use cell phones regularly as teenagers have 4 to 8 times more malignant brain cancers by 10 years later. Now, these are not very welcome results, and we have got to pay attention to them. At this point, we have clear evidence from these studies that have been done of an increased risk of brain cancer in those who are the heaviest users, and we have growing numbers of people around the country who are using these devices heavily. We think it's important for people to understand distance is their friend, and they should try to keep their calls short, use a landline, use a corded line whenever possible, and use wired versus wireless whenever possible. These are ways that you can reduce your exposure. But we really do need to have a national conversation that Camilla Reese and others are encouraging. And I'm really grateful to activists like her and to Ellie Marks, who has been phenomenally important in telling the world the story of her husband, Alan, and his brain cancer that never would have arisen if they had been aware of the warnings that are now buried in these devices.
And to add to that list, would you also say do not, when you're talking, don't put the phone to your ear, use the speakerphone?
Absolutely. Use a speakerphone or a headset. We've been talking with manufacturers lately about creating a phone that only worked with a headset or speakerphone. If that were the case, think how much safer these things would be. We still have many other issues to deal with, of course, and one of them has to do with wireless in schools, where routers are being located by the IT department with no consideration about the need to keep exposure to children as low as possible. That is why the Israeli government has recommended no Wi-Fi in schools with very young children. That is why the French have banned Wi-Fi from nurseries. And we need to get on board with what other countries are doing here and not keep hiding behind the fact that in the United States we are frankly well behind the research that's being done in India, for example.
Dr. Deborah Davis is an award-winning scientist, author, and founding director of Environmental Health Trust. She's the author of Disconnect, The Truth About Cell Phone Radiation. Camilla Reese is a health and environmental activist and co-author of Public Health SOS, The Shadow Side of the Wireless Revolution. Camilla is also founder of the Campaign for Radiation-Free Schools. Dr. Erica Mallory Blythe is a medical doctor. She's one of the UK's few professional advisors on medical conditions related to radio frequency radiation and other electromagnetic fields. And today we are talking about cell phone safety and really wireless device safety, because now these wearables are really exploding, not only for adults but also for children. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about cell phone and wireless device safety? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What do you think of the right-to-know laws? Last month, the Berkeley City Council voted to require cell phone makers to warn customers about potential health risks. The Wireless Association is suing the City of Berkeley over the radiation warning level, claiming the ordinance violates association members' First Amendment rights. We invited the association. They declined our invitation, but they did send us a statement saying that the FCC regulations and the federal government's determinations based on extensive scientific evidence, cell phones approved for sale in the U.S. do not pose a public health risk. So what questions do you have? 866-798-8255. And we have a number of emails already. Sophie writes in about this Wi-Fi ban in France. Why is this moving so quickly in Europe? We're seeing bans, we're seeing a lot of studies, but not so much in the United States. Camilla.
Well, you know, different perspectives on that, but in talking to a lot of doctors in Europe, they say that the countries are smaller. There's, individual media, people participating more in their governments, closer to where decisions are being made, and they're just more health conscious in general, I find.
In the case of France, actually, the French government independently has requested that its scientific groups give it advice, and they did this after a long process. And anyone who independently looks at the information comes to the conclusion that we've got serious concerns about damage to brain cells, damage to sperm, damage to pregnancy. These are not idle issues, and a serious examination of the data shows these effects. So where we are now with cell phones is where we were with cars in the 1950s or 60s. We need airbags, we need seatbelts, and we need to reduce exposures. You would not put your three-year-old behind the wheel of a car. You would not give them a shot of whiskey. We've got to stop treating these things like toys and recognize that they are devices that need to be used safely and in limited ways.
Dr. Mallory Blythe?
Yeah, I think having socialized medical care plays a role as well. When you look at the Russian stance on this, they've got decades of literature that go back further than ours. And sadly, much of that literature hasn't been translated, but they reduced their safety guidelines many years before the rest of the world. And they often talk about that being the result of having to take illness in their workforces very seriously. So they had large numbers of workers who were exposed to microwave radiation occupationally. And with their socialized system, it was very important to take that seriously as quickly as possible in the best interests of everyone, including the finances of their country. So that was addressed really early on. And I think when you look at people who've taken an early stance, it's often those that have really good preventative health care and look at things from a socialized medical point of view and the financial implications of that.
Hmm. Well, and again, the French National Assembly passed a law to entirely ban Wi-Fi in nursery and daycare settings. The ban extends to primary schools, only allowing Wi-Fi to be enabled in classrooms when actively being used for education. So I guess that means it would be turned off.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting. I don't know how technologically they're going to do that, but that is really exciting. That's what we need, you know, on-demand Wi-Fi so you can turn it off. And over in Europe, they also have portable phones today that are only radiating when you're using it, whereas the portable phones here, the decked phones, are radiating 24/7. You know, it maybe might be at the side of your bedside there, whether you're using it or not. So they figured it out for that device, and I'm sure they'll figure it out for Wi-Fi.
And another tip, like right now, I've got my phone right here on my desk, but it's on airport mode. So anytime I'm not using it, and it's not just because we're live, but anytime I'm not using it, I turn it on airport mode, which is also really important.
Yeah, I think that just getting in the practice of, well, being conscious of the fact that these devices are emitting radiation, so that why wouldn't you want to turn it off? You want to preserve your biology. You don't want to get hit. People who are exposed to this radiation, they get fatigued, irritable, headaches, all kinds of symptoms that you can avoid. And in fact, one of them that most people don't know that's terribly important that was mentioned yesterday at the Commonwealth Club is that melatonin is depleted in the presence of this radiation. So anyone who wants to sleep well at night needs to know to turn off that router, or frankly, to not have one at all. You know, we just need to become conscious of it.
Right. And then it's also really important when you're driving, because you're grabbing different signals along the way. So the signal is really, really strong when you're driving. And Deborah, I know you have to leave us in a couple minutes. You mentioned showthefineprint.org. It's a global initiative aimed to educate the public about manufacturers' own health warnings for wireless devices. What is the status of this campaign, and where are you planning to take it?
Well, the city of Berkeley, I think, took a very big and important step, and I was honored to be a part of a tremendous effort by the community there, led by a number of activists in that community, and now championed by Professor Lawrence Lessig, Professor of Ethics at Harvard Law School, and Dean Robert Post of Yale Law School. They are going to be responding to Mr. Olson and his colleagues when it comes to defending this issue. But what we have done there is to take the manufacturer's own advice and put it out so people can find it. And I find it ironic that the industry is seriously arguing that forcing them to show you this information that they bury in their devices violates their First Amendment rights. What about our First Amendment rights? What about our basic right to know? They have a duty to warn, and that duty to warn is not followed by burying information that nobody can see. And I think it's going to be very interesting as this case continues to go, most likely to the Supreme Court. Showthefineprint.org is getting tremendous traction. I spoke to the Boston State House just last week, there were more than 20 senators and representatives there. They are very concerned about this. So is the Commission of Public Health in several states, including Wisconsin, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania. They are starting to hand out materials that can be found on our website under ehtrust.org, where you get links to simple information, Save the Boys, Save the Girls, where we are appealing to people to let youngsters know.
Dr. David Davis is an award-winning scientist and author of Disconnect, The Truth About Cell Phone Radiation. And again, you can find that information, showthefineprint.org. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. To join in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We love to hear new voices on the program. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or simply leave your comment on that site, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say here on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about what it means to buy fair trade coffee. We'll have a conversation about Connected by Coffee. It's a documentary about the lives and history of the people who grow coffee. Over a billion cups of coffee are consumed every day. That's 1 billion. The industry is worth $100 billion, but most rural coffee growers live in poverty. So what can we do to support farmers using fairly traded coffee as a tool for social justice? That's tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation with Wendy Suzuki about her new book, Healthy Brain, Happy Life, a personal program to activate your brain and do everything better. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about cell phone and wireless device safety. Last month, the Berkeley City Council voted to require cell phone companies to warn customers about the potential health risks associated with cell phone radiation. The World Health Organization is out with a paper saying that radiation from cell phones can possibly cause cancer. The Wireless Association is suing the city of Berkeley over the warning, claiming the ordinance violates their members' First Amendment rights. We invited the Wireless Association. They declined our request, but they sent us a statement. Joining us in studio is Camilla Reese, health and environmental activist, co-author of Public Health SOS, The Shadow Side of the Wireless Revolution. She's founder of the Campaign for Radiation-Free Schools. We're also joined by Dr. Erica Mallory Blythe. She's one of the UK's few professional advisors on medical conditions related to radio frequency radiation and other electromagnetic fields. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And before we get to callers, Camilla, you wanted to point out one more thing about showthefineprint.org. Again, this is a campaign to raise awareness about health warnings that are on our phones, but most of us don't read them.
Mm-hmm. And meaning on our phones, meaning in the manual for the phone.
Right.
And in the small print. So it's only logical that whatever is the manufacturers have felt necessary to put in the manual, that if it's important, that it be on the packaging. And so the warnings relate to one category of risk, the thermal effects. That's the only thing that the exposure guidelines address, the possible heating effects of the radiation, like with a microwave oven. We all know that heats, okay? So they're concerned about, engineers are concerned about heating. However, there's a whole nother category of risk, which is from the non-heating frequencies and pulsing that are also biologically active, and a very large body of science. We don't even have guidelines in place yet to address whether they're safe or not, or at what levels. They don't even exist. And then finally, there's the risk from the battery of the phone. There are magnetic fields that come out of the battery. So in the Berkeley situation, that what they're talking about is making, putting up on the packaging at the point of sale, information about the known risk of thermal effects. So, you know, it might be from holding it too close to your body, or it might be they might increase when you're in a train or a car, an elevator also. You know, we need to know when we're coming or when we're approaching levels that would be a thermal concern.
In fact, iPhone manuals ask users to keep the device 5/8 of an inch away from the body. A lot of people we've interviewed say it's about an arm's length, right? Does that make sense, to keep the device about an arm's length away while you're talking?
Well, 5/8 of an inch is just a tiny little bit. So the risk definitely falls off greatly with distance. I would say that what a lot of people do is they say, okay, I'll put it on the speakerphone and I'll hold it right here at my waist level. Well, the radiation, it might be better for your brain, but it's still coming into the rest of your body at that level. So I think we need to, I think we really need to minimize the use of these phones overall and focus on that as the objective, because we can't really say that any distance is going to be safe.
There's a company called Green Swan, and it's an app that yells at you when you're talking too close to your head, to basically give you a warning that, nope, that's too close, you might want to move away. Dr. Mallory Blythe, what are your thoughts on that issue?
Distance is very important, but I would go a step further and say that there's some literature now evolving that shows that lower intensities of radiation can actually, in some cases, be more biologically harmful than the higher intensities. These are called intensity windows of enhanced biological activity. Now, we're in the very embryological stages of understanding this science, and so we've identified some of these windows, and there are frequency windows also. What it means is, essentially, it's not a linear relationship. So whilst there's some common sense in moving the device away, we can't consider that 100% protective. In theory, you could fall into one of these bioactivity windows, where as you move it away, it causes even more harm. Also, just bumping back to what Camilla mentioned, a lot of children are texting these days and holding devices, and tablets especially, holding these devices near their lower abdomen. As Deborah mentioned, the reproductive effects, there's a huge amount of literature here now, and that's very close to some very sensitive and important organs. So, yes, you know, moving it away, there's some common sense, but we really, I think, with vulnerable groups like children, we should be looking at eradicating these types of fields altogether.
Wow. Well, and people do put things on their laps, and it's always best to have something between your body and the device, right?
The biggest distance possible.
Yeah, I would not recommend people put a laptop on their lap. I don't know why they came up with a name like that, because it kind of misleads people into thinking that it's okay to put it on your lap. But a laptop is very close to your body. You've got the magnetic field from the big battery there, as well as the microwaves, and the electric fields also from the device. So I would say if you're going to use a computer, put it on a table.
Armand writes in, a warning is not enough. The phone should include easy-to-read instructions on how to protect yourself. There are bags that can protect users. Leaving the phone off when not talking may be necessary. So there are certain devices now, or protections, right, that are out there to help people. What are your thoughts on those?
So I'm not familiar with what he's talking about, but there are a lot of people that claim that you can put some device on your phone and that it's going to protect you. But I think that that's naive to think that just because something might bring a little subtle energy vibration, maybe through a crystal, that it's going to actually protect you from all the known biological effects. Where's the research showing that that the DNA damage isn't still occurring, or the fertility impacts are not occurring? I tell people, don't look for some magic that you're going to put on your phone at this point. Look to clean up your environment and make your environment, especially your home environment and your bedroom, pristine, so that your body can rest and repair and create safety that way, where you can know for sure and you can measure with a meter whether you are in a clean EMF environment.
So speaking of clean environments, Tim writes in, appreciate you airing this critical information. Is there an inexpensive way to measure the radiation coming from routers in your home?
I think that every community at least should have a meter, if not every family, because it's so educational when you go walk around with a meter, and it makes you realize, especially the ones that make noise as you get closer to a, you know, higher radiation source. It is really the best way to learn, and you can get them. They're called electrosmog meters for radio frequency fields. They're separate meters usually for the magnetic fields. They're electric. I have a website that's called EMF Safety Store that's sort of got some well-screened products on it. And there's a range in price from, you know, $100 to maybe $500 for the consumer audience, and then up into the many thousands for a really professional meter.
Well, thank you for those emails. That is Camilla Reese. She's a health and environmental activist, founder of the Campaign for Radiation-Free Schools, author of Public Health SOS, The Shadow Side of the Wireless Revolution. Dr. Erica Mallory Blythe is a medical doctor, one of the United Kingdom's few professional advisors on medical conditions related to radio frequency radiation. And let's go to Joyce in San Leandro. Hi, Joyce. Welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having this discussion. I'd like to hear more of them. I have a question and a comment. What about texting? Does that seem to have the same effects as actually speaking?
Thank you. Dr. Mallory Blythe, do you want to take that one? We briefly just talked about texting and children.
So texting allows children to keep the device further away from their brain, which is certainly a good thing. At the moment, a lot of the, certainly the data looking at cancer is based on the link with glioma, which is an extremely aggressive brain tumor. The five-year survival is pretty much zero. And radio frequency radiation of this type satisfies what we call the Hill criteria for causality for causing that type of tumor. So that's something we have to take very seriously, and I'm glad that by texting they can keep it further from their brain. However, I'm concerned that as literature evolves, we're seeing more and more biological effects in other parts of the bodies. And reproductive organs are very close to where children are texting. These are very sensitive organs. And I would suggest that all types of use of RF radiation should be absolutely minimized, including texting.
We have a few listeners who are concerned about what's happening in schools. Laura writes, I am hosting a school information presentation to help parents understand and help our school implement best practices for using devices. You can't stop technology, but you have to be smart about how you use it. Thank you for bringing out this topic. People really don't want to hear about it since it means maybe using their devices in a different way. And then a concerned mom in the Bay Area says, how do you convince a school administration that they need to review the Wi-Fi device implementation in a grade school where they see having technology as a competitive advantage to draw new students, equating technology in school with academic excellence with no consideration of health impacts? Is there any threat of legal recourse that can force the administration to review and implement best practices? Camilla, do you want to take that?
Sure. Well, I would start with bringing them education. You can go to Campaign for Radiation-Free Schools and keep up with the flow of information on this topic and what's happening around the world. I recommend that people, at the end of this week, we're going to have the videos posted from yesterday's program at the Commonwealth Club. And I really highly recommend that you go and watch the video by Dr. Carl Merritt about what's happening in schools. I think that it's going to open up a lot of eyes, and perhaps also the 3-minute UN appeal video that we showed that is Dr. Martin Blank from Columbia University in 3 minutes saying, the urgency of this issue. I think that it's very credible. It's too bad because a lot of the associations that represent schools, like the National Association for Independent Schools, they are putting out incorrect information, and they're misleading all the schools in their group. And when people ask, is Wi-Fi safe, they just very quickly put together some cursory letter, oh, yeah, all green, all clear, no problem. And so it's very difficult for parents to fight that, and we are supporting a lot of people, parents out there that are trying to communicate with their schools. It can get ugly, although sometimes they learn and they decide to take out the Wi-Fi. It's happened.
I'll just add to that that there are legal cases now, not just for brain tumours, but also for other symptoms related to this kind of exposure. And sometimes that's grouped under the umbrella electromagnetic hypersensitivity, so characterised by headaches, dizziness, palpitations, insomnia, depression, etc. And there are people now winning legal cases for these kinds of health effects. And the question is, who is responsible for compensating those people? Now, that's a big question mark. And I think schools do need to look very carefully at where their responsibility lies. In the UK, the decision whether or not to have radio frequency fields in a classroom is up to the individual school. It's not to do with the government. That decision lies with them. So it could be that they are then also responsible for that, the risk associated with that and subsequent health effects. And insurance companies are not insuring for this condition in general. It's the underwriters, of course, that make that decision, but I would advise all schools to analyse where they stand in terms of insurance on this particular issue, because they may not be insured for health effects.
Another interesting thing I heard recently from a parent, that in their annual school contract, that they, it's a private school, they have to sign a contract to enroll their child for the next year, and they now have exempted tuition reimbursement for the reason of electromagnetic sensitivity issues.
What would be really nice is to see schools standing up who are proud that they're not using this technology, and they're progressive in terms of protecting health based on science. And there are a number of schools coming out now being proud to say the opposite. There's no requirement for the use of radiation for a very successful IT department. They can use the hardwired internet and achieve exactly the same standard of education. If anything, the science is emerging that says they will actually study and learn and concentrate better in an environment that doesn't have that, even in IT. So it's really progressive schools that are now standing up and saying, we're very proud that we don't have that kind of radiation.
And I think it's also telling that many of the Silicon Valley tech executives send their children to a Waldorf school that has no Wi-Fi.
I read about that. Well, thank you for those emails. Let's hear next from Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I just love that last comment. It's so true. Really wealthy people who are connected want the best for their kids. They give them wooden toys, and they send them to a Waldorf school. My original question was about EMFs, and I actually got a cancer, as did my husband, when we worked in Kiev, Ukraine. We were 60 miles from Chernobyl 10 years later. And, you know, radiation lasts forever. If there's a spill or an accident, it's just there. Now, how much radiation do we have around us in our homes? And what can you do if there's a connection outside the corner of your house that's PG&E or some other company, with a massive box out there? And by the way, if you respond to any of these wonderful new practices, you're considered a Luddite. If you won't sign your kid up for this stuff, you're a Luddite. And I feel like there should be a Luddites Unite or something. I don't
Thank you, Ruby.
Well, I think are you referring to the smart meters?
Yes.
The new utility meters that they're putting on people's homes. Well, the old ones used to be hardwired, and so they were totally safe. And even though there's no need for these new meters, they are putting new meters that radiate, and they're done in different ways. Out here, they're doing them in wireless mesh networks. So it is exposing people in their homes as well as the whole neighborhood. It's essentially creating a new Wi-Fi network in your neighborhood. I know that in, I think it was Santa Cruz, I heard they're now using these Wi-Fi networks for the utilities to offer Wi-Fi internet services. So that really may be the ultimate reason why, one of the ultimate reasons why they're deploying this technology. We wrote a paper 2 years ago called Getting Smarter About the Smart Grid, where we showed technologically that the claims that these meters are needed because they facilitate the integration of renewable technologies and have something to do with sustainability is absolutely false. They have been presented to governments and to communities on false premises and underwritten to the tune of billions of dollars by our federal government facilitating this. And I don't know whether they were just asleep at the switch and it was just a matter of getting those stimulus funding out to whoever applied, like the utilities in this case, or what. But they're something even worse than really than the radiation from these meters that we need as a society need to be looking at. How could this have happened and what is this really about? But in terms of protecting yourself, if you have one of these meters on your house, one of the things that I know people have tried successfully is go to Home Depot, get a big, huge piece of sheet metal and put it on the inside of the house on the back of the back where the meter is, because what that'll at least do is it'll reflect some of it outward. Now, that makes it worse for, you know, where your children might be playing outside. You know, you have to take other things into consideration. But there are at least some things you can do. And I think people need to get engaged on this issue and just don't roll over and get involved. Go to your government representatives and take a stand and you know.
Well, thank you for calling in, Ruby. We have an email from Mimi, and Dr. Mallory Blythe, maybe you can take this one. She writes, I certainly understand the concern for kids. What I'm not understanding is the concern for magnetic radiation, which exists naturally, and what you're currently discussing compares to natural radiation. How what you're currently discussing compares to that. What about compared to X-rays or CTs? Thank you again. And then we also have an email from Rebecca who says, KALW, our station, emits thousands of times more radiation than a cell phone. When are you going to turn off your transmitter to stop infesting the public with brain cancer? You're radiating people who don't listen to KALW without their knowledge and against their will.
I'll take those one at a time. You can perhaps take the second one. But so that first question, I think, was a really important one. A lot of people are trying to allay concern by saying that we evolved in an electromagnetic field. And yes, we absolutely did, but it bears no resemblance to the one that we've now created. So we've created a field that, in terms of signal strengths or power densities, is 10 to the 18, in some cases, times greater. That's technically, I think, a quintillion, a lot of zeros, let's put it that way. But in addition to that, we have taken what was naturally a sort of radio quiet zone. That's at around 1 gigahertz. There's a big dip in natural background radiation. And that is the area in the spectrum that we've filled in. So not only is it a much, much higher power density, but it's also a very foreign set of frequencies. In addition to that, the morphology, the sort of characteristics of these fields are completely different. They're apparently a lot more irritable to biology in terms of their structure. So it's a completely different field. We are designed to cue our biorhythms, etc., with very tiny, subtle electromagnetic fields that were there in terms of evolution. So we're two-way transmission antennas. We're very electromagnetic beings. And what we've now created is something which is unrecognizable. It's almost hard to measure background radiation because what we've produced is so overpowering. And she had another question. Oh, she mentioned ionizing radiation. How does it compare there? So ionizing radiation is a class 1 carcinogen. That's a known human carcinogen. Right now, that means they're in two separate brackets. However, I am a little concerned because some science, when you look, for example, at the COMET assay, this is a test that we do that looks at DNA damage. And there was a study done and published by Adelkoffer some years ago that looked at comparing DNA damage with this test, the COMET assay. And they compared gamma radiation that was equivalent to about 1,600 chest X-rays with just one day, 24 hours of mobile phone radiation below allowable guidelines, and they looked extremely comparable. So a lot more work perhaps needs to be done, but I would say that's a little alarming. And in addition to that, some of the excellent scientists at the International Agency for Research on Cancer, who designated this as a group 2B at the moment, have come out since then. That was back in 2011. And they've said we have more research, more literature, especially the Hill criteria for causality that I mentioned from glioma. And they now feel, some of them, that this should certainly be at least a 2A and in some cases a 1. That would put it in the same group as X-rays and also tobacco and cigarette smoke.
Well, thank you for that, Mimi. And we have some links on our website, yourcallradio.org, and the Commonwealth Club talk will be available soon. Doctors from around the world came to speak about this issue yesterday in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because it can be a little overwhelming when you read about this.
Yeah, we're going to have phenomenal video footage. It was an extremely strong program with people that were, the first program was focused on the clinical situation. What is happening to children? What do we know? What's happening in schools? Let's look at what the children are being bathed in and correlate it with the symptoms and start maybe to look at not just at one moment in time, an exposure and is that safe, but let's look at the cumulative effects over the day that that child was impacted by. And then the final person on the first panel, which was the clinical-oriented panel, was focused on the mental health aspects of of electronics use among children and the radiation, how the wireless radiation exacerbates numerous psychiatric conditions. So it's going to be very interesting to watch. Mm-hmm. And the second panel was focused on the science, bringing us up to date. We had Dr. Davis, who was with us earlier, Martin Paul from Washington State University, Professor Emeritus there, who has been doing a lot of research into the mechanisms, because until we can really understand the mechanisms, the industry can always say there's no evidence for causation. There's no question that these fields are biologically active. There's biological changes, but can we correlate that to health conditions? So, there's plenty of evidence connecting it to health conditions, but until the mechanisms are better understood. So he brought us up to speed on that.
And we just have time for one more caller. We're almost out of time. Let's go to Rick in Santa Cruz. Hi, Rick.
Hi, I was curious. In the frequency of around 1 gigahertz, there's been a lot of military-oriented research regarding the health effects of radiation, specifically directed energy, less than lethal weapons like Raytheon Corporation. From what I can tell, they seem to be rolling that thing out as a solution going forward. And I was just curious, I hear very little, if any, research. I understand that this device is being tested in a prison in California. I saw a petition online fairly recently. I was just curious, what, if any, research, and is anybody even talk about it at this symposium?
Well, we didn't focus on the military science, but I will tell you that there's decades of military science that's readily accessible, and they were the early users and industrial users as well. I mean, there were even hearings on the brain tumor connection with this radiation in the Senate in 1977, long before we even had a consumer cell phone. So, it's an important question to be asking because it adds to the cumulative load that we're exposed to.
We have just about a minute left. Dr. Mallory Blythe, why are you dedicating your life to this issue, and what changes have you personally made based on what you've read and just the work that you do?
So my background originally was emergency trauma medicine. I led trauma teams in hospitals throughout UK and abroad, and I got into this about 6 or 7 years ago in response. Really, to start with, I noticed that a lot of different medical conditions were rising, seemingly inexplicably, and many of the ones I mentioned, so headaches, dizziness, palpitations. And really, doctors clinically felt stuck. And if I'm honest, we were fobbing people off. We were saying, well, it's probably not going to kill you. We can't see anything too seriously wrong with you. Try with palpitations, for example, stop drinking coffee, stop this, stop that. But this really wasn't helping people. They weren't getting better and they were frustrated, and so were the doctors looking after them. And I started doing a bit of reading. I then had some specific patients who came to me and said they believed that their symptoms were being caused by their Wi-Fi or cell phone. And I'll be honest, I found that really hard to believe. Initially, I was quite negative. But then I started doing some reading on their behalf, and I was astonished. I found a huge wealth of literature dating back to the 50s. I couldn't believe it. And I thought, well, I really need to take this more seriously, especially given that there are this big, vulnerable group of children that nobody is currently protecting. So I moved away from trauma medicine, and I've utterly, as you say, dedicated my life now to this field of medicine.
Dr. Erica Mallory Blythe is one of the UK's few professional advisors on medical conditions related to radio frequency radiation. Camilla Rees is founder of the Campaign for Radiation-Free Schools and author of Public Health SOS. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rose. Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
it mean when you buy fair trade coffee? On the next Jorah Call, we'll have a conversation about Connected by Coffee, a documentary about the lives and history of the people who grow coffee. Over a billion cups of coffee are consumed every day. The industry is worth over $100 billion, but most coffee growers live in poverty. So what can we do to support farmers using fairly traded coffee? Do you know where your coffee comes from? It's Jorah Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.